This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, August 4th, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. As climate change and the environment gradually make their way up the priorities list in America, there's a power shift going on in Washington.
A plan 2 years in the making, and the single most important step America has ever taken in the fight against global climate change.
That's President Obama outlining his plan to reduce emissions and reliance on carbon energy over the next 15 years. The plan will rely less on Congress and more on federal regulatory authority to enact the president's so-called Clean Power Plan. This means that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, is going to become a much more powerful agency over the next decade. Think FBI or FDA. A more powerful EPA is something conservatives have railed against for years. And now both parties will have to look at this as the Clean Power Plan finds itself right in the middle of the early campaigning for the 2016 election. Republican Governor Jeb Bush called the plan, quote, irresponsible and overreaching. Senator Marco Rubio warned consumers that the plan would dramatically increase electricity costs for millions of Americans. Last night at the New Hampshire Republican Presidential Candidates Forum, Scott Walker said this.
Well, first off, it's not the clean power plan. It's the costly power plan. It would be like a buzzsaw to the nation's economy. The states like mine and many of the other governors here would be devastated by that.
But the EPA will have a lot to answer for as this debate heats up. And from both sides of the aisle, can it enforce existing environmental laws? Will states abide by emissions targets and energy goals? And what about the EPA's charge to see to it that environmental laws are enforced fairly, to correct cases of discrimination against minorities who bear the brunt of industrial pollution's effects in many places? The EPA Office of Civil Rights is charged with investigating all of that, and it can withhold funds from states and localities that are found liable. But a new investigation from the Center for Public Integrity finds that the agency's Office of Civil Rights rarely takes action under its Title VI authority, despite hundreds of complaints from across the country. Kristen Lombardi, senior reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, has found that the office has treated hundreds of cases with a disturbing lack of urgency, so much so that some plaintiffs have just given up on it.
The Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964. So EPA was created in 1970, and soon after that, it did implement Title VI regulations. But it didn't accept or process complaints until 1993, and that's when the modern sort of Office of Civil Rights, as we know it, processing and adjudicating civil rights claims, sort of came into being. So there were 20 years of regulations, but the first complaint alleging environmental discrimination wasn't accepted by EPA until 1993.
And what form does this discrimination take in the sense that remedies are being improperly applied or unequally applied to certain groups versus other groups, or that facilities are being created with this inequality in mind?
For the majority of complaints that we saw, we examined 15 years worth of complaints and the agency's response to those complaints. The majority dealt with permitting decisions. They were citing, you know, this location is discriminatory or will have a discriminatory effect. And sometimes it was pollution limits, you know, we're receiving the bulk of the pollution as well.
Based on your investigation, is the EPA a good place to take a complaint if you have, as a protected community, a claim of civil rights discrimination?
Not at all. Like I said, we looked at 15 years worth of complaints in the agency's response, and it's pretty much a pattern of denial, delay, and dismissal. 9 out of 10 times communities, their claims are rejected outright without investigation, or they're dismissed upon investigation. There was only one time that the agency found a preliminary finding of a Title VI violation, meaning that the decision that they were investigating did have a discriminatory effect, but it was never formalized because there was a negotiated settlement that came out of that case. So, you know, we talked to dozens of advocates and residents and lawyers who handle these cases, and they say, first of all, it's an underutilized legal tool that the agency has to actually combat environmental injustice. But it's almost laughable, the record, you know. And so we don't even advise our communities to take this path. And a lot of communities feel like, you know, they're the typical environmental justice community, but they have little recourse if they choose to go the Title VI route.
What could possibly be the rationale for over 15 years having virtually no claim come to any fruition on behalf of a citizen complainant?
Well, that's, you know, that's the really interesting question. And we actually interviewed quite a few former and current EPA officials, either who worked in the office and were actually investigating these complaints, or they worked closely with the office. And everybody says the same thing. The agency over the years just doesn't know how to handle these cases. They don't know what environmental discrimination looks like.
What communities do you recall in your investigation that are particularly egregious or mystifying?
Well, the story that we came out with looks at a neighborhood in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, called University Place Subdivision. It's predominantly African American, a neighborhood of pretty much single family residences, some apartment buildings. And since 1960, there has been a city sewage plant right next to that neighborhood. When it first began operating, it was barely visible to neighborhoods. But over the decades, it's been expanded and sort of transformed into an industrial complex. And there's nothing but a two-lane street separating the sewage plant from the neighborhood. Since 2009, the neighborhood residents in the neighborhood have filed 5 complaints with the EPA's Office of Civil Rights, saying the city has violated our civil rights by not just citing the plant there, but operating it in such a way that we are victim to invasions of sewer flies, which are well documented in state records, bad odors, I mean human waste odors, and water pollutions, incessant water pollutions. This particular plant was a chronic violator of the Clean Water Act. And so it's not just that the city cited this plant here, but it's been operating this plant in a way in which we're experiencing the adverse effects. And we thought, wow, this is a pretty strong case, and at least the EPA should investigate. But 4 of those 5 complaints were dismissed outright for technical reasons, really, on procedural grounds, some of which the EPA could waive if it wanted to.
And has anything been done?
Well, I mean, residents call the Office of Civil Rights the do-nothing office. You know, they're very adamant about the fact that it's a sort of an exercise in futility, filing a complaint with the EPA's Civil Rights Office. What they did was team up with a local environmental group. They did file a civil lawsuit against the city, which, you know, got stuck in court, 10 years worth of litigation that ended in a ruling saying they were not entitled to personal injury damages. So that went nowhere. But they did team up with a local environmental group, and they sued under the Clean Water Act over those water pollution violations, those permit violations. And they ended up forcing the city to move some – the city has agreed to move some of the residents, only 41 households – and to create a buffer zone, a 300-foot buffer zone around this facility. Now, residents would say that doesn't take away the fact that our civil rights were violated because we've lost our community. We have had to move.
This is one of how many claims you investigated?
Almost 300, 265.
EPA's an explanation for all this?
The EPA did not deny our numbers. We spoke with the current Office of Civil Rights Director, Velveeta Golightly Howell. She did acknowledge problems processing the complaints, and she said, you know, we can't focus on the past. The past is over. There's nothing we can do about it, but we can focus on the present and the future, and we are.
Kristen Lombardi is senior reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Don.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This is a story of how serious money can be made in America by entrepreneurs with some clever chemistry who prey on the least powerful people living in the shadows in poor inner-city neighborhoods. A homeless shelter in Brooklyn. People on the streets, walking on a lifeless patch of ground amidst some rundown brick buildings. Not many pleasures here. For parolee James, one of them is smoking a bitter street drug called K2.
My name is James, and I started smoking K2 back when I was on parole. I was on parole, and you can't smoke marijuana on parole. So they were selling them in Broadway and Myrtle for $5 a pack. You get 4 grams, roll them up in the blunt, you smoke it. Nobody bother you.
K2, or spice as it's sometimes called, was originally the creation of American scientists who wanted a synthetic version of marijuana for laboratory purposes. But variations can be easily made by amateur scientists to produce molecules that bind to the same receptor in the brain as cannabis. But you wouldn't exactly call this high getting stoned.
K2 is one of it's like a hard drug. It's like crack or heroin, because when you first do it, you get a really bad high. It's not a friendly high like marijuana where you're just like, oh, well, I feel nice, I'm calm. K2, you feel like you're going to have a heart attack, or you're vomiting, or you're passing out, or you're in a different block wandering and you're lost. And you're coming out of your high going, where am I? So K2's, after you do it the first time, the second and third time is easier. And then the fourth time, it starts decreasing.
K2 costs almost nothing. It takes the few dollars these homeless men have, and in return they get a high that can last up to 4 hours. 4 hours to forget living in a shelter, standing around on a patch of dirt. Staff writer for Vice, Ali Conti, reported on the highs and lows of the K2 scourge in a poor homeless community in Brooklyn, and the people enslaved for less than a dollar a day.
K2 is actually one of the names, it was a brand name for one of these original synthetic marijuana brands that you could buy in bodegas maybe 6 years ago. Now it's just kind of like saying Kleenex for tissue. It's research chemicals that are sprayed onto organic material, whatever it is, to be smoked. It's hard to define, actually. It can be a number of things.
It's chemists, entrepreneurs, opportunists who are basically coming up with molecules to spray on smokable substances that then gets sold on the street.
Right. From what I can understand and what I've found doing interviews, it doesn't take much chemistry knowledge to make this stuff. But it can basically be anything that affects the brain or affects the same receptors that smoking marijuana would affect. But it's altering THC just a little bit.
And what did you find was the high that people got here? It ranges the gamut. It's not necessarily like marijuana at all.
No, it's not. I have personally, I've tried it in college, like maybe when this was first available, being very stupid. So I know how it affected me, and it didn't do much, honestly. So I would never try it now, seeing how it's affecting people where they're having seizures or it's becoming catatonic and just becoming very violent. It's a whole range of reactions, and it's just because it's impossible to say, you know, what the dose is because it's unregulated and what the actual chemical is. It could be many different things. So it's impossible to actually define what K2 is.
And legally, there's a whole gray area in terms of how you define this substance, although the specific substance that was sold at bodegas 6 years ago is now a substance that's, you know, categorized by the government and is legal, a controlled substance. That's not the case with these new things.
Right. We're in like a so-called second generation of K2 or spice. There were about 5 chemicals that were originally banned. It's a cat and mouse game. So those chemicals are banned by the DEA. And now there's just, they've slightly altered them. So they're technically different, but there are 5 new chemicals, basically.
And what's the cost of this substance on the street?
You can buy it for $5. 5 grams of it is $5 in a bodega. You can roll, you know, 5 pretty significant joints with that.
Here's someone that we spoke with on the street in New York, in an area not dissimilar from where you looked, describing the experience of being on spice and describing sort of where their life is at, that they might be vulnerable to this. And I want you to just take a listen.
I feel like lightheaded. You feel high. You feel like you don't feel like you have good equilibrium, you know? You feel like you're off balance.
What do you think about when you're on it?
Yeah, I think about, man, how the hell I can get my life together. I think about, you know, situation I'm in. You know, where I'm gonna get my next meal from. I gotta stop smoking this. You know, gotta get myself together. I gotta get some help some way.
Now, that individual, whose name is James, is describing a life of extreme vulnerability. Is that the kind of thing that you found?
Yeah, absolutely. These gentlemen that I spoke to do not want to be using this drug. Across the board, they would much rather be smoking marijuana, where the effects are much more predictable. I mean, it's terrifying. I mean, you have people who are acting like superhuman strength, ripping their clothes off, acting unpredictably, getting violent. The summer has had just an epidemic of this. These guys are standing outside smoking this all day. It's extremely hot out. You know, they're fainting. It's a public health crisis, absolutely.
Ali Conti is a staff writer for Vice. Her story, how synthetic weed is ravaging Brooklyn's homeless population, can be found at vice.com.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years, with services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
This country's war on terrorism can be fairly said to have made a glaring strategic error. The U.S. focuses on Muslim extremists and jihadists from the Middle East and South Asia. The U.S. declares ISIS and al-Qaeda as outcasts from faraway nations who have constructed a violent ideology by co-opting elements of Islam into a mutant religion of their own. One thing we never hear is how the ISIS-al-Qaeda tactics and methods of recruiting are exactly like the growth of radical Christian groups in the United States, groups who say they are working to provoke a racial war right here. Author Stuart Wexler says there is a deep history in America of religious extremism that has been inspiring disaffected young people in Charleston like shooter Dylan Roth for decades. Wexler is the author of America's Secret Jihad, The Hidden History of Religious Terrorism in the United States. Wexler believes the Christian-based terrorism in the U.S. is at least as much of a threat as anything from the groups in the Middle East.
If you look at somebody like ISIS, why are they putting out those videos? They're trying to provoke us into what they think is an apocalyptic Armageddon in the Middle East that will usher in the end of times. What are the folks that I'm writing about interested in? They're trying to polarize the races so that they can get a race war, which is in their mind what is the Armageddon, that's the true Armageddon in the Bible.
There's even an acronym for this, which has been around for a while, that you can find on the tattoos of some of the FBI's most wanted. What is it?
It's RAHOA, Racial Holy War. It actually comes from a guy by the name of Ben Clausen, who wrote The White Man's Bible in the early 70s and created a group called the Church of the Creator, which is almost like a pantheistic sort of religious, racist, terrorist idea. And it became in the 1990s the World Church of the Creator. And they actually inspired, at the very least, many acts of domestic terrorism. And it's tattooed on a lot of white supremacists' bodies. And I would imagine not all of them even know the true origins of it. And that's what's so insidious about it.
And what you write about is that the goal of many of these organizations going way back in the 20th century is the purity of the white race and a civilization that is freed of any multicultural influences.
Yeah, so they see people of color as being subhuman.
Well, there's a name, mud people.
Yes, exactly, mud people. They see them as being subhuman, children of the beasts of the field in the book of Genesis, and they want them basically ethnically cleansed outside of the United States. They think Jews are literally demonic from a second seed line from Eve and Satan. And they believe that they need to actually be wiped out and eliminated.
Would you say that the shooting in Charleston was an anticipated act of terrorism based on the way this ideology plays on individuals, lone individuals like a Dylan Roof?
I think it does. I think you can trace it back from Roof to the material that he's reading online to another religion that was very heavily influenced by the Christian identity folks, Odinism. And there are neo-pagan Odinists who are not racist and not violent, but this one particular strand has enormous influence nowadays. And do I think Dylan Roof, was he an Odinist? No. Were the people whose ideas influenced him into action? I think so. And then they trace all the way back again to Christian identity.
Al-Qaeda worked as this sort of ideologically driven franchise operation, which would encourage people to do certain things, even if they weren't actually involved in sleeper cells and specific sort of fundraising mechanisms for Al-Qaeda. Do you think jihadism, Christian jihadism in the United States works the same way?
I think in some ways it does. And in many ways, that's become almost a preferred approach because they've been so infiltrated in the last 20, 30 years by their own design, and you can find the actual strategy is written about this. They're forced into trying to radicalize lone wolves. So they've sort of outsourced their violence. So if you look at a group like the Phineas Priesthood, the gentleman who shot up the embassy in Austin in 2014 was a member. That's almost like an informal brotherhood of Christian identity terrorists. And no one controls them. No one does anything except they read a book by one gentleman, and then they become radicalized into the idea.
Do you think at our peril, Americans and law enforcement in particular prefer to think of white actors who commit violence against African Americans for the purpose of some personal ideology as mentally ill versus as part of a very loose terrorist network in the United States?
That's way too often the case where they just dismiss somebody as being deranged. But even when they argue that somebody has some sort of influence from a white supremacist group, I don't think they look far enough to see if this particular element, this Christian identity element, had anything to do with that group.
Are these good times for these groups, or are these really fringe times for these groups who are in a kind of last gasp scenario as America begins to address race in a more open and potentially transparent way?
I guess there's good and bad in both. I think their pool of potential sort of applicants or influence is going to be shrinking. But that very fact that America seems to be moving in a particular direction, I think, alarms these people and may, in fact, encourage more terrorism.
And in terms of our view of the Middle East, do we not learn lessons at home when we try to analyze what's going on with ISIS?
I think we do. And I think part of the issue with, say, a group like ISIS is the need to look at really deeply at the religious element of why they're doing what they're doing and not just throw them into this broad Islamic umbrella and look at what do Salafi jihadists want. Even the difference between ISIS and Al-Qaeda is worth examining to some extent. I'm actually more concerned about Al-Qaeda still because ISIS is so concerned about the near enemy and Al-Qaeda is still concerned about the far enemy, the West.
Stuart Wexler is the author of America's Secret Jihad, The Hidden History of Religious Terrorism in the United States. Thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Swedish, statistics, and sword fighting. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Another photo revealed a surface-to-air missile assembly depot, a base to supply the offensive sites.
From deep inside the Cold War isolation of the mid-20th century, American music manages to slip behind enemy lines. American jazz on the radio, led by one man who would become more famous than any Cold War general.
Time for jazz. Willis Conover in Washington, D.C. with the Voice of America Jazz Hour.
That was incredible. I tell you, not only for me, but for millions of people around the world.
Valery Ponomarev was one of those millions of people living behind the Iron Curtain who planned their day around the Willis Conover Jazz Hour on Voice of America. While presidents in Moscow and Washington rattled their nuclear sabers, Conover's records each night wailed saxophone, big band, swing, and bebop. The sound of freedom for young Valery Ponomarev.
When I first heard jazz music, like real jazz music. I was blown away from this earth, you know, with the sounds of incredible Clifford Brown and Max Roach Quintet. Can you imagine, like, to hear something like that for the first time? Jazz music was my music from that point on.
The VOA broadcast everywhere but the USA, and Willis Conover's audience made him one of the most famous radio personalities in the world, famous everywhere except the United States. And 40 years after his death, a postage stamp has been proposed to honor Conover's musical contribution to ending the Cold War, which spanned more than four decades. Valery Ponomarev was surprised when he eventually came to America in 1973 to see that there weren't giant posters and billboards of Willis Conover everywhere. The notes Valeri plays on his own trumpet, he says, came from practicing what he heard on those original Conover Jazz Hour broadcasts.
The person who's solely responsible for advertising, for presenting such an incredible form of art as jazz music, born in the United States, is not known in his own country. Yeah. That's amazing.
And how did you learn jazz from the Voice of America?
Here we go. Yeah. So I was swept away off my feet, you know, listening to that. And I raced around Moscow, which is a huge city, as you know, to look for jazz recordings. There were no recordings proper, like LPs. But on tapes were a lot. And shortly after, actually, lo and behold, you know, I bought some actual LPs on the black market. That was incredible to own, actually possess, you know, hard copy of LP. My first LP I got was Clifford Brown. Studying Brown. Beautiful. So, like many, many people around the world, millions of people around the world, you know, I was glued to my radio short band dial, and they were all extended from 7, all uneven numbers, through 31. I still remember myself sitting there and turning the dial.
That's
finding
the frequencies.
Finding the one which would be the best. So I had a huge, actually pretty good collection of music. And later when I finally was already in the States, I couldn't find some of the LPs I had on tapes. And from them I learned. You ask me how I learned. Here you go. You have your music. You have your paper. You have your ears. You have your pencil. You write it down. You analyze it. You practice it. You apply it to your own playing. And before you know it, you know, I was speaking actually the language of jazz without any accent. Yeah. Before I knew it.
Do you think Willis Conover knew what he was doing with his jazz music hour, that it was having such an impact among you and your friends?
I didn't know if he was aware what kind of impact he would be making. But in terms of playing right music, he definitely knew what he was doing. He was picking up, like, Duke Ellington, Art Blakey, Charlie Parker, of course, Coltrane, all the right people, you know? In that sense, he knew exactly what he was doing. But what kind of impact it would make on the world, I'm not sure if he knew it. But soon after, you know, it started to come back to the United States. People come from Eastern Europe and, where is jazz? Where is there? People loved the United States because of jazz music. So jazz did a lot for America.
How big of an audience do you think he had?
Those programs, yeah. Voice of America?
Yeah.
Voice of America. Millions of people glued to the station at the hour when it starts. Glued. I would be in a hurry not to miss it.
And when you came to the States, did it surprise you that nobody had any idea who Willis Conover was?
Yes. Did. The story goes like this. I am in Washington at the concert in memory of Willis Conover. It was like his first anniversary of his death, or maybe second or so. And a lot of musicians, all coming from outside of the United States, all who grew up on that music, coming from that station, from that program. Yours truly. We're standing there, and I'm kind of warming up for the concert with my trumpet. So I'm warming up, right, getting for a jazz concert, only jazz musicians there. And I hear some kid or somebody trying to work out a stupid rock and roll lick on his alto saxophone. It totally didn't fit in the situation, you know. Maria Siliberti, lady who used to work in his office, I said, Maria, what is that? Oh, it's the guy he'll be playing at the concert. I said, what do you mean at the concert? This is jazz concert in memory of Willis Carnival. She said, no, one of the producers wanted him at the concert. How? I said, well, if you only knew. I said, what? Willis Carnival, all his professional life, was fighting off all these producers who used to push on him this nonsense or that nonsense or this nonsense.
Rock and roll.
Whatever nonsense it was, they used to push on him. He was fighting them off. No. I want to play Charlie Parker. I want to play Duke Ellington. I want to play Count Basie. I want to play The Messengers. I want to play
right.
Jastet. I want to play Art Blakey, and so on and so forth. And they kept on pushing on him. All his life, he was fighting off these people who actually tried to take him off the air. He really had to fight for his program. Imagine if it was not Willis Carnival. Imagine if it was somebody else who didn't have those firm convictions, who didn't really know enough about jazz music, but was appointed. Listen, play to the world something. They will like it. They will love our country, you know, or something.
History would have been different.
History would have been. Me, millions of people would have never been exposed to real sounds of America. Or would have been exposed much later. Just such a form of art, it would have persevered anyways, but much later, if not for Willis Carnival. My life and millions of my contemporaries would have been definitely different.
Well, Larry, I can't imagine a better tribute to Willis Carnival.
I owe it to Willis Carnival, as millions of people around the world.
Valery Ponomarev is a Russian trumpeter who came to the United States from the Soviet Union in 1973. You can read more of Valery's story in his memoir, On the Flip Side of Sound. And here's something to take with you today. Today is President Obama's day. It's no day off. Happy birthday, President Obama. Oval Office meeting with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on Iran, climate change meeting, his weekly lunch with Vice President Joe Biden. Now, how's that going to go? Biden says, hey, birthday boy, should I run? Obama says, I don't know if I would want to run for president if I was in my 70s. Wouldn't you love to be a fly on the wall for that lunch? 72-year-old vice president, maybe aspiring president, with a 54-year-old current president thinking about January of 2017. Happy birthday, Obama. That's all for today, but you can respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway, or you can comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.